Early one morning in 1992, weeks before Prime Minister Narasimha Rao took office, Intelligence Bureau operatives were conducting an electronic sweep to secure the highest office in our country. For a few awful minutes, it seemed to them that a foreign intelligence service had got there first. Inside a phone, there was a recording device and a miniature radio transmitter. Then someone recognized the device. It had been planted there years earlier by the Intelligence Bureau itself to surveil illegally one of Prime Minister VP Singh's top aides. In the midst of fast political and bureaucratic changes, someone had forgotten to remove the spy contraption. Intelligence Bureau officer Maloy Dhar recorded in his memoirs. A similar operation had targeted President Zail Singh as tensions between Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi and Rashtrapati Bhavan reached boiling point in 1987. Fresh evidence has now surfaced that illegal political surveillance by the intelligence services remains endemic, down to the state police services. Last week, police in Telangana arrested police officer Dukila Praneet Kumar, who is suspected of having carried out espionage against opposition leaders during the Bharat Rashtra Samiti government. Kumar served in the Telangana State Intelligence Bureau, a police organization responsible for monitoring Maoist insurgent groups. Ever since 1991, when evidence emerged that the Rajiv Gandhi government had conducted illegal wiretaps, not just of its opponents, but also its own ministers, similar scandals have punctuated the course of Indian politics. From Gujarat in 2013 to Karnataka in 2019, Maharashtra 2022, this subversion of the law and democratic institutions has gone completely unpunished. Learning from their colonial predecessors, India's intelligence services seem to think they're there to protect India's rulers from Indians. Like the pigs in George Orwell's Animal Farm, the nationalists who inherited the surveillance apparatus of the empire were to turn it on their own people. Following the Great Rebellion of 1857, the East India Company's Thuggi and Dakethi Department, fresh from a successful campaign against murderous gangs of highway bandits, was assigned the task of also gathering political intelligence. Viceroy Richard Bourke's assassination in 1872 had made clear the threat to the colonial authorities. Faced with continuing threats from jihadists in the northwest borderlands, as well as unrest in Bengal and Punjab, the empire understood that it needed to expand its intelligence networks to guard against future uprisings. Edward Bulwer Lytton, Viceroy of India from 1876 to 1880, would describe the Thuggi and Dakethi department as, and I quote, virtually our secret police department. Historian Richard Popplewell has recorded that the actual strength of the new networks was quite thin. The largest detective force in Bengal was made up of just one deputy inspector general, four assistants, and 32 head constables, while the Punjab special branch had one officer, two clerks, and one native or Indian inspector. This rudimentary intelligence gathering system was given teeth under Nathaniel Curzon, who became Viceroy in 1899. A Department of Criminal Intelligence, or DCI, was set up by the Government of India to gather and analyze information generated by all its provincial police forces. Though the central organization was not tasked with conducting its own investigations, it was given a small grant of £733, in those days about 11,000 rupees, to recruit spies. Early in the 20th century, as nationalist terrorism grew in Bengal and Punjab, the DCI's resources were expanded. Led by Charles Stevenson Moore, it set up a fingerprint bureau, a photographic section, and even hired a handwriting analyst. In 1906, the DCI appointed its first Indian officer, Assistant Deputy Director Munshi Azizuddin. The budget of the DCI also expanded dramatically as the tempo of terrorism accelerated. Following the near-successful assassination of Viceroy Richard Harding in 1912, historian and former Intelligence Bureau officer Amiya Samanta has written, the British learned painful lessons about how anemic the DCI still really was. Led by Imperial Police Officer David Petrie, a special DCI unit believed that by April 1913, there was, I quote, scarcely a single person all over India capable of being considered as a potential factor in the bomb conspiracy, whose doings have not been subjected to careful scrutiny. Yet, the British found nothing that would help them identify the perpetrators of the attack on Harding. Finally, the provincial police officers, Geoffrey Denham and Charles Taggart, discovered the nationalist networks which were behind the attacks and arrested the perpetrators, with the exception of Rash Bihari Bose, who was never apprehended. Historian Patrick French has noted that, quote, for the last three decades of British rule in India, intelligence gathering was extended massively, since with the rapid rise of the Congress, it was seen as the only way of retaining the upper hand. Covertly obtained information began to take on increasing importance in the formulation of policy and decision-making. In 1919, the Government of India Act mandated that the Intelligence Bureau would keep imperial authorities informed of all matters related to the security of the Indian Empire. There were no provisions for legislative oversight of the organization, nor protection for citizens' rights. But even today, absolutely nothing has changed. To no one's surprise, the expanding Intelligence Bureau very often clashed with the aspirations of India's nationalist movement and the new provincial assemblies that were elected in 1935 as a step towards self-rule. I quote, top secret files relating to the non-cooperation and civil disobedience movement were sent to the offices of the CIO, the Central Intelligence Officer of the Intelligence Bureau, which was statutorily secured from ministerial influence. Samantha has recorded, the provincial governments frequently complained that they were being spied on by central intelligence, but were powerless to do anything about it. Imperial authorities also expanded their surveillance against Indian nationalists overseas. Led by the Punjab police officer P.C. Vickery, a special unit called Indian Political Intelligence, or IPI, was set up inside the security service MI5. The organization's activities would lead to considerable friction with the Indian diaspora. For much of India's post-independence history, the Intelligence Bureau's record would be scarred by controversy. From the records of the commission which investigated the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, it is clear that the Intelligence Bureau's capacities to gather intelligence on hostile political movements was at best limited. Though the Intelligence Bureau had received information on the possibility of an assassination, it came from the Uttar Pradesh police. All the IB did was pass it on to the Bombay police. The IB also notably misjudged the threat from China ahead of the war of 1962, asserting that, I quote, war between India and China would escalate on a global level with the potential of a nuclear conflagration, and therefore China would desist from it. That was, of course, one of the most disastrous miscalculations in our country's history. In Kashmir, Intelligence Bureau Station Chief Inderjeet Singh Hasanwalia, handpicked by Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, was credited with bringing a peaceful conclusion to the crisis involving the disappearance of a holy relic from the shrine of Hazrat Bal in Srinagar in 1962. However, the Intelligence Bureau also developed an unhappy reputation for participating in political and electoral manipulation. The organization also failed to predict the scale of the crisis which would envelop the state after 1988, when thousands of young people crossed the line of control to train at terrorist camps in Pakistan. From the 1970s, the Intelligence Bureau's role in political surveillance, mostly of dubious legality, expanded steadily, with successive directors becoming enmeshed in government efforts to undermine opponents. These operations were to bring the Bureau into enormous disrepute during and after the emergency of 1975-1977. The Intelligence Bureau also came to play a controversial role in conducting background checks on appointees to high office, like judges of the High Courts and Supreme Court, although it had no legal charter to conduct such activities. 11 years ago, National Security Advisor and former IB Director Ajit Dovan noted that the last thoroughgoing review of the organization's objectives and methods had taken place in the 1980s under his predecessor M.K. Narayanan. He argued for an official review to shape, I quote, new doctrines, suggest structural changes, aim at optimization of resources, and examine administrative and legislative changes required for empowerment of intelligence agencies. That's excellent advice. But almost 10 years after Mr. Doval became National Security Advisor, nothing has really happened. Ending the political abuse of intelligence in India means the government needs to make state and central services creatures of law, not political whim. This is not surprisingly something no political party is really interested in doing, even though all, while in opposition, have suffered the consequences of illegal surveillance and coercion. Law scholars like Vrinda Bhandari and Karan Lahiri have argued that a legal framework for Indian intelligence services must include judicial and legislative oversight of its surveillance operations, the kind of oversight liberal democracies around the world have put in place. Left unregulated, intelligence services can become enemies of the values and laws of their own nations, as a United States Senate investigation famously discovered of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1975. This lesson India has been taught several times over since the emergency. But as a nation, we seem determined to shut our eyes to the problem. I'm Praveen Swamy, and I'm a contributing editor at The Print. Thank you for watching Security Corps.